A few one-room shacks came and went, perched on tall poles that made them look like cranes. Of the folk who lived there, they saw no sign. Birds flew overhead, or cried out from the trees along the shore, and Jamie glimpsed silvery fish knifing through the water. "Tully trout, there's a bad omen," he thought, until he saw worse. One of the floating logs that passed turned out to be a dead man, bloodless and swollen. His cloak was tangled in the roots of a fallen tree, its colour unmistakably Lannister crimson. He wondered if the corpse had been someone he knew. The forks of the Trident were the easiest way to move goods or men across the riverlands. In times of peace, they would have encountered fisherfolk in their skiffs, grain barges being poled downstream, merchants selling needles and bolts of cloth from floating shops, perhaps even a gaily painted mummer's boat with quilted sails of half a hundred colours, making its way upriver from village to village and castle to castle. But the war had taken its toll. They sailed past villages, but saw no villagers. An empty net, slashed and torn, and hanging from some trees, was the only sign of fisher folk. A young girl, watering a horse, rode off as soon as she glimpsed their sail. Later they passed a dozen peasants digging in a field beneath the shell of a burnt tower house. The men gazed at them with dull eyes and went back to their labours once they decided the skiff was no threat. The Red Fork was wide and slow, a meandering river of loops and bends dotted with tiny wooded islets and frequently choked by sandbars and snags that lurked just below the water's surface. Brian seemed to have a keen eye for the dangers, though, and always seemed to find the channel. When Jamie complimented her on her knowledge of the river, she looked at him suspiciously and said, "I do not know the river. Tarth is an island. I learned to manage oars and sail before I ever sat horse." Sir Cleo sat up and rubbed at his eyes. "Gods, my arms are sore. I hope the wind lasts." He sniffed at it. "I smell rain." Jamie would welcome a good rain. The dungeons of River Run were not the cleanest place in the Seven Kingdoms. By now he must smell like an overripe cheese. Cleo squinted downriver. "Smoke!" A thin grey finger crooked them on. It was rising from the south bank several miles on, twisting and curling. Below, Jamie made out the smouldering remains of a large building, and a live oak full of dead women. The crows had scarcely started on their corpses. The thin ropes cut deep into the soft flesh of their throats, and when the wind blew, they twisted and swayed. "This was not chivalrously done," said Brian, when they were close enough to see it clearly. "No true knight would condone such wanton butchery."
"True knights see worse every time they ride to war, wench," said Jamie. "And do worse, yes."
Brian turned the rudder towards the shore. "I'll leave no innocence to be food for crows."
"A heartless wench. Crows need to eat as well. Stay to the river and leave the dead alone, woman."
They landed upstream of where the great oak leaned out over the water. As Brian lowered the sail, Jamie climbed out, clumsy in his chains. The Red Fork filled his boots and soaked through the ragged breeches. Laughing, he dropped to his knees, plunged his head under the water, and came up drenched and dripping. His hands were caked with dirt, and when he rubbed them clean in the current, they seemed thinner and paler than he remembered. His legs were stiff as well, and unsteady when he put his weight upon them.
"I was too bloody long in Huster Tully's dungeon."
Brian and Cleos dragged the skiff onto the bank. The corpses hung above their heads, ripening in death like foul fruit.
"One of us will need to cut them down," the wench said.
"I'll climb," Jamie waded ashore, clanking. "Just get these chains off."
The wench was staring up at one of the dead women. Jamie shuffled closer with small stutter steps, the only kind the foot-long chain permitted. When he saw the crude sign hung about the neck of the highest corpse, he smiled.
"They lay with lions," He read, "Oh, yes, woman, this was most unchivalrously done. But by your side, not mine. I wonder who they were, these women."
"Tavern wenches," said Sir Cleofrey. "This was an inn, I remember it now. Some men of my escort spent the night here when we last returned to River Run."
Nothing remained of the building but the stone foundation and a tangle of collapsed beams, charred black. Smoke still rose from the ashes. Jamie left brothels and whores to his brother Tyrion. Circe was the only woman he had ever wanted. "The girls pleasured some of my lord father soldiers, it would seem. Perhaps serve them food and drink. That's how they earn their traitors' collars, with a kiss and a cup of ale." He glanced up and down the river to make certain they were quite alone. "This is Brackenland. Lord Jonas might have ordered them killed. My father burned his castle. I fear he loves us not."
"It might be Mark Piper's work," said Sir Cleus, "or that wisp of the wood, Beric Dondarrion, though I'd heard he kills only soldiers. Perhaps a band of Roose Bolton's Northmen."
"Bolton was defeated by my father on the Green Fork."
"But not broken," said Sir Cleos. "He came south again when Lord Tywin marched against the Fords. The word at Riverrun was that he'd taken Harrenhal from Sir Aimery Lorch."
Jamie liked the sound of that not at all. "Brienne," he said, granting her the courtesy of the name in the hopes that she might listen.
"If Lord Bolton holds Harrenhal, both the Trident and the King's Road are likely watched."
He thought he saw a touch of uncertainty in her big blue eyes.
"You are under my protection. They'd need to kill me."
"I shouldn't think that would trouble them."
"I am as good a fighter as you," she said defensively. "I was one of King Renly's chosen seven. With his own hands he cloaked me with the striped silk of the Rainbow Guard."
"The Rainbow Guard, oh, you and six other girls, was it? A singer once said that all maids are fair in silk. But he never met you, did he?"
The woman turned red.
"We have graves to dig."
She went to climb the tree. The lower limbs of the oak were big enough for her to stand upon, once she had gotten up the trunk. She walked among the leaves, dagger in hand, cutting down the corpses. Flies swarmed around the bodies as they fell, and the stench grew worse with each one she dropped.
"This is a deal of trouble to take for whores," Sir Cleos complained. "What are we supposed to dig with? We have no spades, and I will not use my sword. I—"
Brienne gave a shout. She jumped down rather than climbing.
"To the boat! Be quick! There's a sail!"
They made what haste they could, though Jamie could hardly run, and had to be pulled back into the skiff by his cousin. Brienne shoved off with an oar and raised sail hurriedly.
"Sir Cleos, I'll need you to row as well."
He did as she bid. The skiff began to cut the water a bit faster. Current, wind, and oars all worked for them. Jamie sat chained, peering upriver. Only the top of the other sail was visible. With the way the Red Fork looped, it looked to be across the fields, moving north behind a screen of trees, while they moved south. But he knew that was deceptive. He lifted both hands to shade his eyes.
"Mud red and watery blue," he announced.
Brienne's big mouth worked soundlessly, giving her the look of a cow chewing its cud.
"Faster, sir."
The inn soon vanished behind them, and they lost sight of the top of the sail as well, but that meant nothing. Once the pursuers swung around the loop, they would become visible again.
"We can hope the noble Tullys will stop to bury the dead whores, I suppose."
The prospect of returning to his cell did not appeal to Jamie.
"Tyrion could think of something clever now, but all that occurs to me is to go at them with a sword."
For the good part of an hour they played peek and seek with the pursuers, sweeping around bends and between small wooded isles. Just when they were starting to hope that somehow they might have left behind the pursuit,
The distant sail became visible again. Sir Cleus paused in his stroke.
"The others take them."
He wiped the sweat from his brow.
"Row," Brayin said.
"That is a river galley coming after us," Jamie announced after he'd watched for a while. With every stroke, it seemed to grow a little larger.
9 oars on each side, which means 18 men. More if they're crowded on fighters as well as rowers, and larger sails than ours. We cannot outrun her."
Sir Cleus froze at his oars.
18, you said? 6 for each of us. I'd want 8, but these bracelets hinder me somewhat.
Jamie held up his wrists.
Unless the Lady Brian would be so kind as to unshackle me.
She ignored him, putting all her efforts into her stroke.
"We had half a night's start on them," Jamie said. "They've been rowing since dawn, resting 2 oars at a time. They'll be exhausted. Just now the sight of our sail has given them a burst of strength, but that will not last. We ought to be able to kill a good many of them."
Sir Cleus gaped.
"But there are 18. "At the least. More like 20 or 25.
His cousin groaned.
"We can't hope to defeat 18.
"Did I say we could? The best we can hope for is to die with swords in our hands." He was perfectly sincere. Jaime Lannister had never been afraid of death. Brienne broke off rowing. Sweat had stuck strands of her flax-coloured hair to her forehead, and her grimace made her look homelier than ever.
"You are under my protection," she said, her voice so thick with anger that it was almost a growl. He had to laugh at such fierceness. "She's the hound with tits," he thought, "or would be, if she had any tits to speak of."
"Then protect me, wench, or free me to protect myself."
The galley was skimming downriver, a great wooden dragonfly. The water around her was churned white by the furious action of her oars. She was gaining visibly, the men on her deck crowding forward as she came on. Metal glinted in their hands, and Jamie could see bows as well.
Archers.
He hated archers. At the prow of the onrushing galley stood a stocky man with a bald head, bushy grey eyebrows, and brawny arms. Over his mail he wore a soiled white surcoat with a weeping willow embroidered in pale green, but his cloak was fastened with a silver trout.
"River runs captain of guards."
In his day, Sir Robin Ryger had been a notably tenacious fighter, but his day was done. He was of an age with Hoster Tully, and had grown old with his lord. When the boats were 50 yards apart, Jamie cupped his hands around his mouth and shouted back over the water,
"Come to wish me Godspeed, Sir Robin."
"Come to take you back, Kingslayer,"
Sir Robin Ryger bellowed.
"How is it that you've lost your golden hair?"
"I hope to blind my enemies with the sheen off my head. It's worked well enough for you."
Sir Robin was unamused. The distance between skiff and galley had shrunk to 40 yards.
"Throw your oars and your weapons into the river, and no one need be harmed."
Sir Cleus twisted around.
"Jamie, tell him we were freed by Lady Catelyn, an exchange of captives, lawful."
Jamie told him, for all the good it did.
"Catelyn Stark does not rule in River Run,"
Sir Robin shouted back. 4 archers crowded into position on either side of him, 2 standing and 2 kneeling.
"Cast your swords into the water."
"I have no sword," he returned, "but if I did, I'd stick it through your belly and hack the balls off those 4 cravens."
A flight of arrows answered him. 1 thudded into the mast, 2 pierced the sail, and the 4th missed Jamie by a foot. Another of the red fork's broad loops loomed before them. Brian angled the skiff across the bend. The yards swung as they turned, their sail cracking as it filled with wind. Ahead, a large island sat in midstream. The main channel flowed right. To the left, a cut-off ran between the island and the high bluffs of the north shore. Brian moved the tiller and the skiff sheered left, sail rippling. Jamie watched her eyes.
Pretty eyes, he thought, and calm.
He knew how to read a man's eyes. He knew what fear looked like.
She is determined, not desperate.
30 yards behind, the galley was entering the bend.
Sir Cleos, take the tiller, the wench commanded. Kingslayer, take an oar, and keep us off the rocks.
As my lady commands.
An oar was not a sword, but the blade could break a man's face if well swung, and the shaft could be used to parry. Sir Cleos shoved the oar into Jamie's hand and scrambled aft. They crossed the head of the island and turned sharply down the cut-off, sending a wash of water against the face of the bluff as the boat tilted. The island was densely wooded, a tangle of willows, oaks, and tall pines that cast deep shadows across the rushing waters, hiding snags and the rotting trunks of drowned trees. To their left, the bluff rose sheer and rocky, and at its foot, the river foamed whitely around broken boulders and tumbles of rock fallen from the cliff face. They passed from sunlight into shadow, hidden from the galley's view between the green wall of the trees and the stony grey-brown bluff.
A few moments' respite from the arrows, Jamie thought, pushing them off a half-submerged boulder.
The skiff rocked. He heard a soft splash, and when he glanced around, Brian was gone. A moment later he spied her again, pulling herself from the water at the base of the bluff. She waded through a shallow pool, scrambled over some rocks, and began to climb. Sir Cleos goggled, mouth open.
"Fool," thought Jamie.
"Ignore the wench," he snapped at his cousin. "Steer!" They could see the sail moving behind the trees. The river galley came into full view at the top of the cut-off, 25 yards behind. Her bow swung hard as she came around, and a half-dozen arrows took flight, but all went well wide. The motion of the two boats was giving the archers difficulty, but Jamie knew they'd soon learn to compensate. Brian was halfway up the cliff face, pulling herself from handhold to handhold.
"Rygar's sure to see her, and once he does, he'll have those bowmen bring her down."
Jamie decided to see if the old man's pride would make him stupid.
"Sir Robin!" he shouted. "Hear me for a moment!"
Sir Robin raised a hand, and his archers lowered their bows.
"Say what you will, Kingslayer, but say it quickly!"
The skiff swung through a litter of broken stones as Jamie called out,
"I know a better way to settle this. Single combat. You and I." "I was not born this morning, Lannister." "No, but you'll like to die this afternoon."
Jamie raised his hand so the other could see the manacles.
"I'll fight you in chains. What could you fear?" "Not you, sir. If the choice were mine, I'd like nothing better. But I am commanded to bring you back alive, if possible. Bowman,"
he signaled them on,
"notch, draw, loop."
The range was less than 20 yards. The archers could scarcely have missed, but as they pulled on their longbows, a rain of pebbles cascaded down around them. Small stones rattled on their deck, bounced off their helms, and made splashes on both sides of the bow. Those who had the wits enough to understand raised their eyes just as a boulder the size of a cow detached itself from the top of the bluff. Sir Robin shouted in dismay. The stone tumbled through the air, struck the face of the cliff, cracked in two, and smashed down on them. The larger piece snapped the mast, tore through the sail, sent two of the archers flying into the river, and crushed the leg of a rower as he bent over his oar. The rapidity with which the galley began to fill with water suggested that the smaller fragment had punched right through her hull. The oarsmen's screams echoed off the bluff while the archers flailed wildly in the current. From the way they were splashing, neither man could swim. Jamie laughed. By the time they emerged from the cut-off, the galley was foundering amongst pools, eddies, and snags, and Jamie Lannister had decided that the guards were good. Sir Robin and his thrice-damned archers would have a long, wet walk back to Riverrun, and he was rid of the big, homely wench as well.
I could not have planned it better myself, once I am free of these irons.
Sir Cleos raised a shout. When Jamie looked up, Bryene was lumbering across the clifftop well ahead of them, having cut across a finger of land while they were following the bend in the river. She threw herself off the rock and looked almost graceful as she folded into a dive. It would have been ungracious to hope that she would smash her head on the stone. Sir Cleos turned the skiff toward her. Thankfully, Jamie still had his oar.
"One good swing when she comes paddling up, and I'll be free of her."
Instead, he found himself stretching the oar out over the water. Bryene grabbed hold, and Jamie pulled her in. As he helped her into the skiff, water ran from her hair and dripped from her sodden clothing to a pool on the deck.
"She is even uglier wet. Who would have thought it possible?"
"You're a bloody stupid wench," he told her. "We could have sailed on without you. I suppose you expect me to thank you."
"I want none of your thanks, Kingslayer. I swore an oath to bring you safe to King's Landing."
"And you actually mean to keep it?"
Jamie gave her his brightest smile.
"Now, there's a wonder."
Catelyn. Sir Desmond Grell had served House Tully all his life. He'd been a squire when Catelyn was born, a knight when she learned to walk and ride and swim, master-at-arms by the day she was wed. He had seen Lord Huster's little cat become a young woman, a great lord's lady, mother to a king. And now he has seen me become a traitor as well. Her brother Edmure had named Sir Desmond Castellan of Riverrun when he rode off to battle, so it fell to him to deal with her crime. To ease his discomfort, he brought her father's steward with him, Dor Uthereyde Swain. The two men stood and looked at her. Sir Desmond, stout, red-faced, embarrassed, Uthereyde, grave, gaunt, melancholy. Each waited for the other to speak. "They have given their lives to my father's service, and I have repaid them with this grace," Catelyn thought wearily.
"Are your sons," Sir Desmond said at last. "Maester Wyman told us, the poor lads, terrible, terrible. But—"
"We share your grief, my lady," said Uthereyde Swain. "All Riverrun mourns with you, but—"
"The news must have driven you mad," Sir Desmond broke in. "A madness of grief, a mother's madness. Men will understand. You did not know."
"I did," Catelyn said firmly. "I understood what I was doing, and I knew it was treasonous. If you fail to punish me, men will believe that we connived together to free Jamie Lannister. It was mine own act, and mine alone, and I alone must answer for it. Put me in the Kingslayer's empty irons, and I will wear them proudly, if that is how it must be."
"Fetters!" The very word seemed to shock poor Sir Desmond. "For the king's mother, my lord's own daughter, oh, impossible."
"Mayhaps," said the steward Uthereyde Swain, "my lady would consent to be confined to her chambers until Sir Edmure returns, a time alone to pray for her murdered sons."
"Confined, aye," Sir Desmond said, "confined to a tower cell that would serve."
"If I am to be confined, let it be in my father's chambers, so I might comfort him in his last days."
Sir Desmond considered for a moment. "Very well. You shall lack no comfort nor courtesy, but freedom of the castle is denied you. Visit the sept as you need, but elsewise remain in Lord Huster's chambers until Lord Edmure returns."
"As you wish." Her brother was no lord while their father lived, but Catelyn did not correct him. "Set a guard on me, if you must, but I give you my pledge that I shall attempt no escape." Sir Desmond nodded, plainly glad to be done with his distasteful task, but sad-eyed Uthereyde Swain lingered a moment after the Castellan took his leave.
"It was a grave thing you did, my lady, but for naught.
Sir Desmond has sent Sir Robin Reiger after them to bring back the Kingslayer, or, failing that, his head.
Catelyn had expected no less. "May the warrior give strength to your sword arm, Brian," she prayed. She had done all she could. Nothing remained but to hope. Her things were moved into her father's bedchamber, dominated by the great canopy bed she had been born in, its pillars carved in the shapes of leaping trout. Her father himself had been moved half a turn down the stair, his sickbed placed to face the triangular balcony that opened off his solar, from whence he could see the rivers that he had always loved so well. Lord Huster was sleeping when Catelyn entered. She went out to the balcony and stood with one hand on the rough stone balustrade. Beyond the point of the castle, the swift tumblestone joined the placid red fork, and she could see a long way down river. If a striped sail comes from the east, it will be Sir Robin returning. For a moment, the surface of the water was empty. She thanked the gods for that, and went back inside to sit with her father. Catelyn could not say if Lord Huster knew she was there, or if her presence brought him any comfort, but it gave her solace to be with him. "What would you say if you knew my crime, father?" she wondered. "Would you have done as I did, if it were Lysa and me in the hands of our enemies? Or would you condemn me too, and call it mother's madness?" There was a smell of death about that room, a heavy smell, sweet and foul, clinging. It reminded her of the sons she had lost, her sweet Bran and her little Rickon, slain at the hand of Theon Greyjoy, who had been Ned's ward. She still grieved for Ned. She would always grieve for Ned. But to have her babies taken as well. "It is a monstrous, cruel thing to lose a child," she whispered softly, more to herself than to her father. Lord Huster's eyes opened.
"Kenzie,"
he husked, in a voice thick with pain. "He does not know me." Catelyn had grown accustomed to him taking her for her mother, or her sister Lysa, but Tansy was a name strange to her. "It's Catelyn," she said. "It's Cat, father."
"Forgive me the blood. Oh, please, Tansy."
Could there have been another woman in her father's life, some village maiden he had wronged when he was young, perhaps? Could he have found comfort in some serving wench's arms after mother died? It was a queer thought, unsettling. Suddenly she felt as though she had not known her father at all. "Who is Tansy, my lord? Do you want me to send for her, father? Where would I find the woman? Does she still live?" Lord Huster groaned.
"Dead."
His hand groped for hers.
"You will have others, sweet babes, and true-born."
"Others?" Catelyn thought. "Has he forgotten that Ned is gone? Is he still talking to Tansy? Or is it me now, or Lysa, or mother?" When he coughed, the sputum came up bloody. He clutched her fingers.
"Be a good wife, and the gods will bless you. Sons, true-born sons."
A sudden spasm of pain made Lord Huster's hand tighten. His nails dug into her hand, and he gave a muffled scream. Maester Wyman came quickly to mix another dose of milk of the puppy and help his lord swallow it down. Soon enough, Lord Huster Tully had fallen back into a heavy sleep. "He was asking after a woman," said Cat. "Tansy."
"Tansy?"
The maester looked at her blankly. "You know no one by that name? A serving girl? A woman from some nearby village? Perhaps someone from years past?" Catelyn had been gone from River Run for a very long time.
"No, my lady, I can make inquiries if you like. Authorized Wayne would surely know if any such person ever served at River Run. Tansy, did you say? The small folk often name their daughters after flowers and herbs."
The maester looked thoughtful.
There was a widow, I recall. She used to come to the castle looking for old shoes in need of new soles. Her name was Tansy, now that I think on it. Or was it Pansy? Some such. But she has not come for many years.
Her name was Violet, said Catelyn, who remembered the old woman very well.
Was it? The maester looked apologetic. My pardons, Lady Catelyn, but I may not stay. Sir Desmond has decreed that we are to speak to you only so far as our duties require.
Then you must do as he commands. Catelyn could not blame Sir Desmond. She had given him small reason to trust her, and no doubt he feared that she might use the loyalty that many of the folk of River Run would still feel towards their lord's daughter to work some further mischief. I am free of the ward, at least, she told herself, if only for a little while. After the maester had gone, she donned a woolen cloak and stepped out onto the balcony once more. Sunlight shimmered on the rivers, gilding the surface of the waters as they rolled past the castle. Catelyn shaded her eyes against the glare, searching for a distant sail, dreading the sight of one. But there was nothing, and nothing meant that her hopes were still alive. All that day she watched, and well into the night, until her legs ached from the standing. A raven came to the castle in late afternoon, flapping down on great black wings to the rookery. Dark wings, dark words, she thought, remembering the last bird that had come and the horror it had brought. Maester Vyman returned at evenfall to minister to Lord Tully and bring Catelyn a modest supper of bread, cheese, and boiled beef with horseradish.
I spoke to Uthrise Wayne, my lady. Is quite certain that no woman by the name of Tansy has ever been at River Run during his service.
There was a raven today, I saw. Has Jamie been taken again? Or slain? God's forbid.
No, my lady, we've had no word of the Kingslayer.
Is it another battle, then? Is Edmure in difficulty? Or Rob? Please be kind. Put my fears at rest.
My lady, I should not...
Vyman glanced about, as if to make certain no one else was in the room.
Lord Tywin has left the riverlands. All's quiet on the fords.
Whence came the raven, then?
From the west, he answered, busying himself with Lord Huster's bedclothes and avoiding her eyes.
Was it news of Rob? He hesitated.
Yes, my lady.
Something is wrong. She knew it from his manner. He was hiding something from her.
Tell me, is it Rob? Is he hurt?
Not dead. Gods be good, please do not tell me that he is dead.
His grace took a wound storming the crag, Maester Vyman said, still evasive, but writes that it is no cause for concern, and that he hopes to return soon.
A wound? What sort of wound? How serious?
No cause for concern, he writes.
All wounds concern me. Is he being cared for?
I'm certain of it. The maester at the crag will tend him, I have no doubt.
Where was he wounded?
My lady, I'm commanded not to speak with you. I am sorry.
Gathering up his potions, Vyman made a hurried exit, and once again Catelyn was left alone with her father. The milk of the poppy had done its work, and Lord Huster was sunk in deep sleep. A thin line of spittle ran down from one corner of his open mouth to dampen his pillow. Catelyn took a square of linen and wiped it away gently. When she touched him, Lord Huster moaned,
"Forgive me,"
he said so softly she could scarcely hear the words.
"Tansy, blood, the blood, gods be kind."
His words disturbed her more than she could say, though she could make no sense of them.
Blood, she thought. Must it all come back to blood? Father, who was this woman? And what did you do to her that needs so much forgiveness?
That night, Catelyn slept fitfully, haunted by formless dreams of her children, the lost and the dead. Well before the break of day, she woke with her father's words echoing in her ears. Sweet babes and trueborn. Why would he say that, unless... Could he have fathered a bastard on this woman Tansy? She could not believe it. Her brother Edmure, yes, it would not have surprised her to learn that Edmure had a dozen natural children. But not her father, not Lord Huster Tully, never. Could Tansy be some pet name he called Lysa, the way he called me Cat? Lord Huster had mistaken her for her sister before. "You'll have others," he said, "sweet babes and trueborn." Lysa had miscarried 5 times, twice in the Aerie, thrice at King's Landing, but never at River Run, where Lord Huster would have been at hand to comfort her. Never, unless she was with child that first time. She and her sister had been married on the same day, and left in their father's care when their new husbands had ridden off to rejoin Robert's rebellion. Afterward, when their moon blood did not come at the accustomed time, Lysa had gushed happily of the son she was certain they carried. "Your son will be heir to Winterfell and mine to the Aerie. Oh, they'll be the best of friends like your Ned and Lord Robert. There'll be more brothers and cousins, truly, I just know it." She was so happy. But Lysa's blood had come not long after, and all the joy had gone out of her. Catelyn had always thought that Lysa had simply been a little late. But if she had been with child. She remembered the first time she gave her sister Rob to hold, small, red-faced and squalling, but strong even then, full of life. No sooner had Catelyn placed the babe in her sister's arms than Lysa's face dissolved into tears. Hurriedly, she had thrust the baby back at Catelyn and fled. If she had lost a child before, that might explain father's words, and much else besides. Lysa's match with Lord Arryn had been hastily arranged, and John was an old man even then, older than their father. An old man without an heir. His first 2 wives had left him childless. His brother's son had been murdered with Brandon Stark in King's Landing. His gallant cousin had died in the Battle of the Bells. He needed a young wife, if House Arryn was to continue. A young wife, known to be fertile. Catelyn rose, threw on a robe, and descended the steps to the darkened solar to stand over her father. A sense of helpless dread filled her. "Father," she said. "Father, I know what you did." She was no longer an innocent bride with a head full of dreams. She was a widow, a traitor, a grieving mother, and wise, wise in the ways of the world. "You made him take her," she whispered. "Lysa was the price John Arryn had to pay for the swords and spears of House Tully." Small wonder her sister's marriage had been so loveless. The Arryns were proud and prickly of their honour. Lord John might wed Lysa to bind the Tullys to the cause of the rebellion, and in the hopes of a son, but it would have been hard for him to love a woman who came to his bed soiled and unwilling. He would have been kind, no doubt, dutiful, yes, but Lysa needed warmth. The next day, as she broke her fast, Catelyn asked for quill and paper, and began a letter to her sister in the Vale of Arryn. She told Lysa of Bran and Rickon, struggling with the words, but mostly she wrote of their father. "His thoughts are all of the wrong he did you, now that his time grows short. Maester Vimer says he dare not make the milk of the puppy any stronger. It is time for father to lay down his sword and shield. It is time for him to rest. Yet he fights on grimly, will not yield. It is for your sake, I think. He needs your forgiveness. The war has made the road from the Aerie to River Run dangerous to travel, I know, but surely a strong force of knights could see you safely through the Mountains of the Moon, 100 men or 1,000. And if you cannot come, will you not write him, at least, a few words of love, so he might die in peace. Write what you will, and I shall read it to him, and ease his way. Even as she set the quill aside and asked for sealing wax, Catelyn sensed that the letter was like to be too little and too late. Mr. Wyman did not believe Lord Huster would linger long enough for Raven to reach the Eyrie and return, though he has said much the same before. Tullyman did not surrender easily, no matter the odds. After she entrusted the parchment to the maester's care, Catelyn went to the sept and lit a candle to the father above for her own father's sake, a second to the crone who had let the first raven into the world when she appeared through the door of death, and a third to the mother, for Lysa and all the children they had both lost. Later that day, as she sat at Lord Huster's bedside with a book, reading the same passage over and over, she heard the sound of loud voices and a trumpet's blare. "Sir Robin," she thought at once, flinching. She went to the balcony. There was nothing to be seen out on the rivers, but she could hear the voices more clearly from outside, the sound of many horses, the clink of armour, and here and there a cheer. Catelyn made her way up the winding stairs to the roof of the keep. "Sir Desmond did not forbid me the roof," she told herself as she climbed. The sounds were coming from the far side of the castle, by the main gate. A knot of men stood before the portcullis as it rose in jerks and starts, and in the field beyond, outside the castle, were several hundred riders. When the wind blew, it lifted their banners, and she trembled in relief at the sight of the leaping trout of River Run. Edmure. It was 2 hours before he saw fit to come to her. By then the castle rang to the sound of noisy reunions, as men embraced the women and children they had left behind. 3 ravens had risen from the rookery, black wings beating at the air as they took flight. Catelyn watched them from her father's balcony. She had washed her hair, changed her clothes, and prepared herself for her brother's reproaches, but even so, the waiting was hard. When at last she heard sounds outside her door, she sat and folded her hands in her lap. Dried red mud spattered Edmure's boots, greaves, and surcoat. To look at him, you would never know he had won his battle. He was thin and drawn, with pale cheeks, unkempt beard, and 2 bright eyes. "Edmure," Catelyn said, worried, "you look unwell. Has something happened? Have the Lannisters crossed the river?" "I threw them back. Lord Tywin, Gregor Clegane, Adam Marbrand. I turned them away. Stannis, though." He grimaced. "Stannis? What of Stannis?" "He lost the battle at King's Landing," Edmure said unhappily. "His fleet was burned. His army routed." A Lannister victory was ill tidings, but Catelyn could not share her brother's obvious dismay. She still had nightmares about the shadow she had seen slide across Renly's tent and the way the blood had come flowing out through the steel of his gorget. Stannis was no more a friend than Lord Tywin. "You do not understand. Highgarden has declared for Joffrey, Dorne as well, all the south." His mouth tightened. "And you see fit to loose the Kingslayer? You had no right."
"I had a mother's right." Her voice was calm, though the news about Highgarden was a savage blow to Rob's hopes. She could not think about that now, though.
"No right," Edmure repeated. "He was Rob's captive, your king's captive, and Rob charged me to keep him safe."
"Brienne will keep him safe." She swore it on her sword.
"Ach, that woman!"
"She will deliver Jaime to King's Landing and bring Arya and Sansa back to us safely."
"Cersei will never give them up."
"Not Cersei. Tyrion. He swore it in open court, and the Kingslayer swore it as well."
"Jaime's word is worthless. As for the imp, it said he took an axe in the head during the battle. He'll be dead before your Brienne reaches King's Landing, if she ever does."
"Dead? Could the gods truly be so merciless?"
She had made Jaime swear 100 oaths, but it was his brother's promise
she had pinned her hopes on. Edmure was blind to her distress.
"Jamie was my charge, and I mean to have him back. I've sent ravens."
"Ravens? To whom? How many?"
"Three," he answered. "So the message will be certain to reach Lord Bolton. By river or road, the way from River Run to King's Landing must needs take them close by Harrenhal."
Harrenhal? The very word seemed to darken the room. Horror thickened her voice as she said, "Edmure, do you know what you have done?"
"Have no fear. I left your part out. I wrote that Jamie had escaped, and offered 1,000 dragons for his recapture."
Worse and worse, Catelyn thought, in despair. My brother is a fool. Unbidden, unwanted, tears filled her eyes. If this was an escape, she said softly, and not an exchange of hostages, why should the Lannisters give my daughters to Brienne?
It will never come to that. The Kingslayer will be returned to us. I have made certain of it.
All you have made certain is that I shall never see my daughters again. Brienne might have gotten him to King's Landing safely, so long as no one was hunting for them. But now... Catelyn could not go on. "Leave me, Edmure." She had no right to command him, here in the castle that would soon be his, yet her tone would brook no argument.
"Leave me to father, and my grief. I have no more to say to you. Go, go!"
All she wanted was to lie down, to close her eyes and sleep, and pray no dreams would come. Arya. The sky was as black as the walls of Harrenhal behind them, and the rain fell soft and steady, muffling the sound of their horses' hooves and running down their faces. They rode north, away from the lake, following a rutted farm road across the torn fields and into the woods and streams. Arya took the lead, kicking her stolen horse to a brisk, heedless trot until the trees closed in around her. Hot Pie and Gendry followed as best they could. Wolves howled in the distance, and she could hear Hot Pie's heavy breathing. No one spoke. From time to time, Arya glanced over her shoulder to make sure the two boys had not fallen too far behind, and to see if they were being pursued. They would be, she knew. She had stolen 3 horses from the stables, and a map and a dagger from Roos Bolton's own solar, and killed a guard on the postern gate, slitting his throat when he knelt to pick up the worn iron coin that Jake and Hagar had given her. Someone would find him lying dead in his own blood, and then the hue and cry would go up. They would wake Lord Bolton and search Harrenhal from Crennel to Cellar, and when they did they would find the map and the dagger missing, along with some swords from the armory, bread and cheese from the kitchens, a baker boy, apprentice smith, and a cupbearer called Nan, or Weasel, or Arry, depending on who you asked. The Lord of the Dreadfort would not come after them himself. Roose Bolton would stay abed, his pasty flesh dotted with leeches, giving commands in his whispery, soft voice. His man Walton might lead the hunt, the one they call Steelshanks, for the greaves he always wore on his long legs. Or perhaps it would be Slobbery Vargo Holt and his sellswords, who named themselves the Brave Companions. Others called them Bloody Mummers, though never to their faces, and sometimes the Footmen, for Lord Vargo's habit of cutting off the hands and feet of men who displeased him.
"If they catch us, he'll cut off our hands and feet," Arya thought, "and then Roose Bolton will peel the skin off us."
She was still dressed in her page's garb, and on the breast over her heart was sewn Lord Bolton's sigil, the flayed man of the Dreadfort. Every time she looked back, she half expected to see a blaze of torches pouring out of the distant gates of Harrenhal or rushing along the tops of its huge high walls. But there was nothing. Harrenhal slept on, until it was lost in darkness and hidden behind the trees. When they crossed the first stream, Arya turned her horse aside and led them off the road, following the twisting course of the water for a quarter mile before finally scrambling out and up a stony bank. If the hunters brought dogs, that might throw them off the scent, she hoped. They could not stay on the road.
There is death on the road, she told herself. Death on all the roads.
Gendry and Hot Pie did not question her choice. She had the map after all, and Hot Pie seemed almost as terrified of her as of the men who might be coming after them. He had seen the guard she'd killed.
It's better if he's scared of me, she told herself. That way he'll do like I say instead of something stupid.
She should be more frightened herself, she knew. She was only 10, a skinny girl on a stolen horse with a dark forest ahead of her, and men behind who had gladly cut off her feet. Yet somehow she felt calmer than she ever had in Harrenhal. The rain had washed the guard's blood off her fingers. She wore a sword across her back. Wolves were prowling through the dark, like lean grey shadows, and Arya Stark was unafraid. Fear cuts deeper than swords, she whispered under her breath, the words that Cyrio Forel had taught her, and Jaqen's words too, Velar Morghulis. The rain stopped, and started again, and stopped once more, and started, but they had good cloaks to keep the water off. Arya kept them moving, at a slow, steady pace. It was too black beneath the trees to ride any faster. The boys were no horsemen, neither one, and the soft broken ground was treacherous with half-buried roots and hidden stones. They crossed another road, its deep ruts filled with runoff, but Arya shunned it. Up and down the rolling hills she took them, through brambles and briars and tangles of underbrush, along the bottoms of narrow gullies where branches heavy with wet leaves slapped at their faces as they passed. Gendry's mare lost her footing in the mud once, going down hard on her hindquarters and spilling him from the saddle, but neither horse nor rider was hurt, and Gendry got that stubborn look on his face and mounted right up again. Not long after, they came upon three wolves devouring the corpse of a fawn. When Hot Pie's horse caught the scent, he shied and bolted. Two of the wolves fled as well, but the third raised his head and bared his teeth, prepared to defend his kill.
"Back off!" Arya told Gendry. "Slow, so you don't spook him."
They edged their mounts away until the wolf and his feast were no longer in sight. Only then did she swing about to ride after Hot Pie, who was clinging desperately to the saddle as he crashed through the trees. Later they passed through a burned village, threading their way carefully between the shells of blackened hovels and past the bones of a dozen dead men hanging from a row of apple trees. When Hot Pie saw them, he began to pray, a thin, whispered plea for the mother's mercy, repeated over and over. Arya looked up at the fleshless dead in their wet, rotting clothes, and said her own prayer.
"Sir Gregor," it went, "Dunson, Polliver, Raff the Sweetling, the Tickler and the Hound, Sir Ilion, Sir Merrin, King Joffrey, Queen Cersei."
She ended it with Velar Morghulis, touched Jaqen's coin where it nestled on her belt, and then reached up and plucked an apple from among the dead men as she rode beneath them. It was mushy and overripe, but she ate it, worms and all. That was the day without a dawn. Slowly the sky lightened around them, but they never saw the sun. Black turned to grey, and colours crept timidly back into the world. The soldier pines were dressed in sombre greens, the broad leaves in russets, and faded golds, already beginning to brown. They stopped long enough to water the horses and eat a cold, quick breakfast, ripping apart a loaf of bread that Hot Pie had stolen from the kitchens, and passing chunks of hard yellow cheese from hand to hand.
"Do you know where we're going?" Gendry asked her.
"North," said Arya. Hot Pie peered around uncertainly.
"Which way is north?"
She used her cheese to point.
"That way."
"But there's no sun. How do you know?"
"From the moss. See how it grows mostly on one side of the trees? That's south."
"What do we want in the north?"
Gendry wanted to know. "The Trident." Arya unrolled the stolen map to show them. "See? Once we reach the Trident, all we need to do is follow it upstream till we come to River Run. Here." Her finger traced the path. "It's a long way, but we can't get lost so long as we keep to the river." Hot Pie blinked at the map. "Which one is River Run?" River Run was painted as a castle tower in the fork between the flowing blue lines of two rivers, the Tumblestone and the Red Fork. "There," she touched it. "River Run," it reads.
"You can read writing,"
he said to her, wonderingly, as if she said she could walk on water. She nodded. "We'll be safe once we reach River Run."
"We will. Why?"
"Because River Run is my grandfather's castle, and my brother Rob will be there," she wanted to say. She bit her lip and rolled up the map.
"We just will, but only if we get there."
She was the first one back in the saddle. It made her feel bad to hide the truth from Hot Pie, but she did not trust him with her secret. Gendry knew, but that was different. Gendry had his own secret, though even he didn't seem to know what it was. That day Arya quickened their pace, keeping the horses to a trot as long as she dared, and sometimes spurring to a gallop when she spied a flat stretch of field before them. That was seldom enough, though. The ground was growing hillier as they went. The hills were not high nor especially steep, but there seemed to be no end of them, and they soon grew tired of climbing up one and down the other, and found themselves following the lay of the land, along stream beds, and through a maze of shallow wooded valleys, where the trees made a solid canopy overhead. From time to time she sent Hot Pie and Gentry on, while she doubled back to try to confuse their trail, listening all the while for the first sign of pursuit. "Too slow," she thought to herself, chewing her lip. "We're going too slow. They'll catch us for certain." Once, from the crest of a ridge, she spied dark shapes crossing a stream in the valley behind them, and for half a heartbeat she feared that Roose Bolton's riders were on them. But when she looked again, she realized they were only a pack of wolves. She cupped her hands around her mouth and howled down at them.
"Oh-hoo! Oh-hoo!"
When the loudest of the wolves lifted its head and howled back, the sound made Arya shiver. By midday, Hot Pie had begun to complain. His arse was sore, he told them, and the saddle was rubbing him raw inside his legs, and besides, he had to get some sleep.
"I'm so tired, I'm going to fall off the horse."
Arya looked at Gendry.
"If he falls off, who do you think will find him first, the wolves or the mummers?" "Oh, the wolves," said Gentry. "Better noses."
Hot Pie opened his mouth and closed it. He did not fall off his horse. The rain began a short time later. They still had not seen so much as a glimpse of the sun. It was growing colder, and pale white mists were threading between the pines and blowing across the bare, burned fields. Gendry was having almost as bad a time of it as Hot Pie, although he was too stubborn to complain. He sat awkwardly in the saddle, a determined look on his face beneath his shaggy black hair, but Arya could tell he was no horseman. "I should have remembered," she thought to herself. She had been riding as long as she could remember, ponies when she was little, and later horses, but Gendry and Hot Pie were city-born, and in the city small folk walked. Yoren had given them mounts when he took them from King's Landing, but sitting on a donkey and plodding up the King's Road behind a wagon was one thing. Guiding a hunting horse through wild woods and burned fields was something else. She would make much better time on her own, Arya knew, but she could not leave them. They were her pack, her friends, the only living friends that remained to her, and if not for her, they would still be safe at Harrenhal. Gendry, sweating at his forge and Hot Pie in his kitchens. "If the mummers catch us, I'll tell them that I'm Ned Stark's daughter and sister to the king in the north. I'll command them to take me to my brother and to do no harm to Hot Pie and Gendry." They might not believe her, though.
and even if they did, Lord Bolton was her brother's bannerman.